Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is September 30, 1980, and this is my audio letter number 58. The fall of 1980 is turning out to be a season of reruns. Television shows which were stale the first time around are being shown again, thanks to the actor's strike in Hollywood. And the worst acts of all are those of our so-called presidential candidates. Administrations come and go, my friends, but the more they legislate, the more the country goes to the dogs. Millions of Americans are out of work, but inflation refuses to quit. Interest rates are heading up again, so say goodbye to that new home. Our auto industry is on the ropes. Our cities are decaying. Our armed forces are falling apart. And at the center of it all, our dollar is shrinking out of existence. The dollar is no longer good as gold because our gold is gone. And as long as it stays gone, all the campaign promises in the world cannot save the United States economy. The forces who stole our gold are bringing down America's economy, and now they are using our own gold to bring down war around our heads. My friends, it's time to lift our eyes from idle campaign promises to cast our vote for America before it is too late. It's time for us, the American people, to use the gold weapon ourselves. It's time for us to vote for the truth by bringing about a public investigation of the Fort Knox gold scandal, because only in that way can we hope to save our economy from utter ruin, and only in that way can we seize a weapon big enough to stop those who are dragging us all into the insanity of Nuclear War I. My three special topics this month are Topic number 1, American Gold and the Iraq-Iran War. Topic number 2, Russia's first strike against a Titan II missile. And Topic number 3, Step 3 in what you can do. Topic number 1. The world we live in today, my friends, seems more and more like a roller coaster. Only a short month ago, we were hearing about the worldwide oil glut. There were predictions that it could easily take 1 or 2 years for the oil surplus to fade away. But rosy projections like those always seem to set the stage for trouble. This month of September got off to a bad start as the dollar fell to the lowest level in 5 years on money markets worldwide. Something ominous was in the wind. You and I were not told about it, but a new crisis was brewing between Iran and Iraq. On September 9, Great Britain shut down its embassy in Tehran, saying it was becoming too dangerous. Iraq and Iran were squabbling over their border, and the dispute was heating up. Iraqi troops invaded northwestern Iran, seizing some 90 square miles of Iranian territory. Then on September 17, after the fact, Iraq tore up the 1975 border treaty with Iran. Next, the air war erupted between the two countries. On September 22, Iraq and Iran bombed each other's airfields. And the very next day, two OPEC nations, Iraq and Iran, began destroying each other's oil installations. The headline in the Washington Post for September 24, 1980 said it all. Iran bombs Baghdad. Full-scale war erupts. The present fighting between Iraq and Iran was started by Iraq. For many years we've heard about the status of Iraq as a Russian client state, and with the war now underway, we are always reminded of this by the controlled major media of the United States. But what is not reported to you and me, my friends, is Russia's reaction to Iraq's latest actions. The Russians have sent very blunt warnings to Iraq that they are not pleased and have shut off arms shipments to Iraq. The Russians are saying basically, "We gave you arms to defend yourself against Israel, not to invade Iran." During roughly the past year and a half, little notice changes have been taking place in Iraq. Those changes have been orchestrated in parallel with those in neighboring Iran. Iraq's new strongman, Saddam Hussein, came to power in a bloody coup d'etat. At the time, all eyes were on Iran instead, but now thousands of Iranian military personnel from the Shah's former regime are now in Iraq. They are fighting on the side of Iraq, hoping to regain power in Iran by military means. In AUDIO LETTER 52 last November 1979, I described how and why agents of the Rockefeller cartel brought to ruin the late Shah of Iran. The Islamic Revolution of Ayatollah Khomeini was secretly helped along as a maneuver to oust the Shah. The Ayatollah was ushered into power by forces which he did not understand, but as I reported in AUDIO LETTER 52, those forces planned to undo it all. What I told you then was, quote, "They plan to martyr the entire Khomeini government as they set off thermonuclear war," unquote. The real Ayatollah Khomeini himself was assassinated last February 1980, as I reported that month in AUDIO LETTER 54, but he was replaced with a double to maintain the image of the Ayatollah as an enemy, someone for the Americans to hate. Now, by way of Iraq, pressure is being put on Iran. The ultimate goal is to make the present government of Iran disintegrate in chaos. But you can expect many twists and turns along the way. Like Iran, Iraq is only being used as a part of a larger plan. There may well be double crosses within double crosses. Almost anything can happen. But watch for efforts to lure Russia into the Persian Gulf, just as she was lured into Afghanistan. The main forces which have brought about the Iraqi attack on Iran are not those of the United States government itself. Instead, the situation in Iraq right now is dominated by the old Rockefeller oil interests. These are headed and tightly coordinated by John J. McCloy and his associates. Since the spring of 1979, I have reported that the Rockefeller cartel as a whole is now headless and beginning to crumble, but that is not yet true of the oil companies within the cartel. They still intend to complete their long-range plan to recapture undisputed domination over Iran, and they are working closely with their private Israeli counterparts here and abroad to accomplish this. Their destruction of the Shah's regime was only the first half of their plan. The second half is to get rid of the interim government now in Iran, the so-called Khomeini regime. They want to destabilize the situation in Iran and take advantage of the chaos that follows. When the smoke clears, Big Oil plans again to own Iran lock, stock, and barrel. And at the same time, the Bolshevik secret government here plans to take advantage of the same events to bring us closer to a nuclear war. Ever since 1914, war after war has been fought over oil. Governments have been destroyed, others created, and still others subverted. And whenever there is war for oil, gold is always the trigger. Gold is such an important weapon of war that in early 1968, the Joint Chiefs of Staff became very alarmed over the depletion of America's gold supply. They visited their then-President Lyndon Johnson in the White House. In an angry confrontation, they demanded that Johnson not reduce the gold stock still remaining because it was needed for purposes of war. The Rockefeller interests, now under the control of John J. McCloy and Associates, arranged earlier this year for $8 billion, that's $8,000 million, in gold to be paid to the leader of Iraq, Saddam Hussein. A very special private underground warehouse in Zurich was used in this transfer of gold. This gold was an outright bribe. It was to persuade Iraq to attack Iran. $8 billion, my friends, is a lot of money. But it was a cheap price for the Rockefeller oil cartel, and for two reasons. First, the gold which was used to bribe Iraq to start the war was part of the gold which was stolen from you and me. The bulk of the gold taken from America's stockpiles was flown to Europe on multinational corporate jets. So, my friends, that $8 billion in gold did not cost the oil companies anything except some jet fuel, but it cost you and me part of our monetary gold, and it has been used to start a war for which you and I will pay even more. $8 billion in gold was a cheap price for the oil companies for another reason, too. If their plans are successful, the Rockefeller Oil Group will get back complete control over Iran's oil and other natural resources, and they won't have to pay those untold billions in oil royalties to their new Iranian lackeys. As I explain in AUDIO LETTER 52, the time came when the oil companies could no longer control their former puppet, the Shah. So out he went. They could also not control for long the real Ayatollah Khomeini, so he was killed. But if their war on Iran by way of Iraq succeeds in its ultimate purpose, the Rockefeller oil companies will once again constitute the Iranian state. The oil interests under John J. McCloy are playing ball with the invisible Bolshevik government here in the United States. For the moment, they both want the same thing in Iran, that is, instability and turmoil. So they are working hand in glove to create an explosion in the Persian Gulf. But the oil companies could end up finding that even they have been used by the Bolshevik secret government here in the United States. Because if the Bolsheviks have their way, all-out war will come before the oil cartel can consolidate their gains in Iran. Last month I revealed that the Bolsheviks here are following roughly a 3-month cycle in triggering new war plans. The coming month of October 1980 is another critical month in that timetable, and sure enough, right on schedule, the Iraq-Iran war is boiling over. The United States Naval Fleet in the Indian Ocean is now being bolstered by units from our Mediterranean Fleet. At the same time, the United States is trying to get Australia, France, which is very reticent, and Great Britain to join in with their navies as well. At the same time, our Bolshevik administration is sending 4 AWACS airborne battle control airplanes to Saudi Arabia. Cargo planes and several hundred support personnel are also on the way. The public excuse is that this is to keep open the critical Strait of Hormuz to keep the oil tankers moving. But, my friends, it may well lead instead to an oil cutoff, and that will produce not only higher oil prices, but also a national emergency here in the United States as we shift step by step onto a war footing. Topic number 2. 3 years ago today, on September 30, 1977, I recorded AUDIO LETTER No. 26. In that tape I reported that the most decisive battle of the 20th century had just taken place in space. It was the Battle of the Harvest Moon, September 27, 1977. It was history's first true battle in space, and in a stunning upset, the United States was defeated by the Soviet Union. From that day onward, Russia began evicting the United States from the military use of space. The true military balance between East and West was turned upside down. Since that time, the United States has been dealing from weakness on the world stage. But our secret Bolshevik government is unwilling to abandon its secret plans for world domination, and so, out of weakness, America has shifted to a first-strike nuclear strategy against Russia. Lately, this dramatic shift in America's military posture has started coming to the surface in the news. For example, last month, Presidential Directives 58 and 59 were made public. One directive, number 59, officially commits the United States to a first-strike nuclear posture known as counter-force targeting of our missiles. The other directive, number 58, is to step up preparations for our leaders to hide in safe war bunkers just before they set off Nuclear War I. And what about you and me and our children? we are supposed to just wait patiently until the air raid sirens start blaring all around us. Our shift to a first strike nuclear posture actually began over 2 years ago, in secret. I first reported this change in AUDIO LETTER 36 for July 1978, and the following month in AUDIO LETTER 37 I gave details of the secret first strike plans then being prepared. In AUDIO LETTER 37 I reported that America's secret plans for a first strike were producing a response in kind by the Kremlin. The Russians had learned about the plans of our own secret government for a first strike, and so they were planning to turn the tables. By allowing the United States to start the process, the Russians were planning to obtain an excuse for their own first strike against us. But I can now report that the Russian first strike strategy has changed in very important ways. My friends, it is already underway. On both sides, the strategic plans for Nuclear War I are in a constant state of flux, and as it happens, the changes on both sides during the past 2 years can be illustrated with a single weapon. That weapon is America's giant Titan II missile. The Titan II is an old missile. It began to be deployed some 18 years ago, in 1962. It is a liquid fuel rocket, unlike our newer Minutemen, which use solid fuel. It is a maintenance headache, and we do not have a large number of them, my friends. Only 54 were deployed originally. But the Titan II has one advantage which has become very important to our Bolshevik secret government. That advantage is sheer size. It has a payload capability, called throw weight by the military, which is many times larger than that of a Minuteman. That gives the Titan II a special value for modification to new missions which were not originally planned. Some 2 years ago, one of these major modification programs was carried out on Titan II missiles. As I reported in AUDIO LETTER 37, they have been modified for fractional orbital bombardment. Normally, American missiles are aimed over the North Pole at Russia, but that is no longer the case with the Titan IIs. When war begins, the Titans will be launched in many different directions, and they will not follow the normal ballistic trajectory of a standard ICBM. Instead, they will accelerate all the way to orbital speed. They will then race around the globe toward Russia. They will approach Russia from all directions, not just from the north, and they will arrive at twice the speed of other missiles. As they approach their targets, the warheads will retrofire out of orbit. From there, they will rain destruction on their Russian targets. At least, that is the plan. American military planners believe that they can succeed in getting at least a few of the Titan IIs launched, in spite of Russia's Cosmospheres on patrol overhead. They also believe that the short flight time of the Titans will keep them safe from Russia's man-killer satellites, the Cosmos Interceptors. Finally, the secret planners here believe that the Russians will find terminal defense impossible. The Titan warheads will simply arrive from too many directions for effective anti-missile defense. But last February 1980, I reported that Russia does plan to have an effective last-ditch defense to shoot down any incoming ICBMs. The Russians began work on it in June 1978, 2 months before I recorded AUDIO LETTER 37. It is a flying anti-ballistic missile system. It is made up of charged particle beam weapons carried by Russia's supersonic transport, the Tu-144. The Tu-144s were suddenly removed from service without explanation in June 1978, and now I can report to you that the Tu-144 flying anti-missile system is fully operational in Russia. Meanwhile, America's fleet of Titan IIs is beginning to dwindle. On August 24, 1978, an accident, supposedly, crippled a freshly modified Titan II at Rock, Kansas. It made headlines with a massive leak which sent poisonous reddish-brown fumes towering into the sky. The huge missile was ruined. Scratch 1, 53 left. Now, my friends, the Titan IIs are being modified again. This time only the warhead is involved. They are still programmed for fractional orbital bombardment, which requires use of a smaller warhead than normal. But now compact new generation warheads are being installed on the Titan IIs. Each packs a 24 megaton wallop. That's over 1,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima A-bomb. But the most deadly feature of the new Titan II warheads is their cobalt jacket. The Titan II warhead is a doomsday weapon designed to create vast amounts of deadly radiation over wide areas for a generation. The Bolsheviks here are well aware of Russia's vast civil defense setup. They know that, unlike the United States, Russia's rulers have tried to ensure that as many Russians as possible will survive a nuclear attack, but the Bolsheviks here plan to make those preparations useless. Even if the Russians stay underground for a year, or 2 years, or 5 years, eventually they will have to come out of their shelters, and if they do so after an American cobalt bomb attack, they will still die. And so, one way or another, the Russians intend to make doubly sure that no Titan II succeeds in bombarding Russia. For nearly 3 years, I have reported that Russia's levitating weapons platforms, the Cosmospheres, can blast our missiles in their silos. And this month, on September 19, that is exactly what was done. The target was a Titan II in its silo near Damascus, Arkansas. The Russians were sending a message to our Bolshevik secret government. Their war of attrition against America's war-making capability is now being stepped up. The Russians are now embarking on their own new version of a first strike, one target at a time. Russian intelligence learned several months ago about the plan to retrofit the Titan IIs with cobalt doomsday warheads. The decision was made to destroy one of these retrofitted missiles in its silo at the first favorable opportunity. The Titans are notorious for their leaks during maintenance. It was decided that the first major leak of a retrofitted Titan II would be used as a cover for the Russian strike. On Thursday, September 18, the Russians got the chance that they were waiting for. Around 6:45 that evening, a retrofitted Titan II with a cobalt doomsday warhead was being worked on in its silo near Damascus, Arkansas. Suddenly, we are told, an accident took place which has no parallel since the Titan IIs became operational 18 years ago. Supposedly, a wrench was dropped, knocking a hole in the side of the missile. In any case, the Russians had the leak they wanted to provide a cover for what they were about to do. For more than 8 hours, Air Force personnel worked steadily, but without great urgency, to try to fix the leak. Meanwhile, the silo door remained closed to avoid attracting attention. The main worry at the time was not an explosion, but toxicity of the fumes. As Air Force Secretary Hans Mark testified to Congress on September 24, quote, "the technical experts did not expect any explosion at all," unquote. As one crew after another entered and left the Titan II silo in protective suits, a Russian Cosmosphere was floating high above in the stratosphere. They waited until after most of the nearby residents had been warned and evacuated. Then at 3:01 a.m., the Cosmosphere crew received the order to open fire. Their charged particle beam weapon had for hours been aimed and ready, locked onto the center of the huge silo door. The door, made of concrete and steel and weighing 740 tons, was designed to withstand a near miss of a 10 megaton H-bomb. But it was no match for the charged particle beam. In a fraction of a second, the beam blew a hole through the silo door. As the door buckled and twisted, the beam created a tremendous shockwave inside the silo. The fragile outer shell of the missile instantly was crushed like an eggshell. The fuel and oxidizer tanks ruptured in 1,000 places, and the propellants ran together. As long as they are kept apart, the fuel and oxidizer of the Titan II offer very little danger of explosion, but they are of a type called hypergolic propellants. That is, the moment they contact each other, they ignite. And that is what happened in the missile silo. Huge amounts mixed instantly as the missile crumpled inward. The result was a tremendous explosion. It threw the already ruined silo door all over the countryside. And the mighty Titan II launched this doomsday warhead not into Russia, but into the Arkansas pasture a few hundred feet away. And so, my friends, there were really two explosions at the Titan II missile silo. First was the explosion of part of the atoms of the silo door itself when it was hit by the particle beam, and that in turn triggered the second explosion, that of the missile itself in the silo. Several eyewitnesses described this double blast in various ways, but the clearest description was given by two injured Air Force personnel, Sergeants Michael Hansen and Archie James. Their statements in a September 21 news conference were reported the next day in the New York Times. The Times said, quote, "The two men said that they were about 100 feet from the missile silo when the first of two explosions occurred. They agreed that there had been one smaller explosion first, which knocked them to the ground, before a much larger explosion with monstrous force." Unquote. After the explosion, the Air Force mystified everyone with its nervousness about the warhead. After all, everyone knows an ICBM carries a nuclear warhead, so why not admit it? Now, my friends, you know why. They were desperately afraid that there might be a slip of the tongue by someone about the new doomsday cobalt warhead of the Titan II, and so strict orders were given to say nothing at all about it. For our Titan II missile fleet, the score is now scratch 2, 52 to go. The Russians are hoping to bring about a shutdown of the Titan missile force by means of public outcry if possible, but if not, they intend to make sure in other ways that not one is ever launched at Russia. The Titan II, with its new 24-megaton cobalt warhead, is a first-strike weapon of our secret government. But the Russians, too, are making use of cobalt bombs in their first-strike strategy against the United States. The Russian cobalt bombs are a totally different design, not for use in the atmosphere, but underground and underwater to generate earthquakes. 2 months ago, on July 28, an earthquake took place in the Midwest that shook 12 states. Geologists in that area were mystified, saying that it seemed like an impossible earthquake. There are no known faults in the area where it was centered, not far from Fort Knox, Kentucky. But in AUDIO LETTER 56, I reported how Russia brought about that seemingly impossible earthquake using two underground cobalt bombs. Last month, this Bolshevik administration announced that Russia's leadership is now a number one target in its first strike posture. And Russia is responding in kind, my friends. The real headquarters of America's secret government is not here in Washington, D.C., but in New York City, and now feverish preparations are underway to create an impossible earthquake in New York City as part of Russia's new first strike campaign against the United States.